lot of all of the comments we were able to call correctly. So I am just going to turn this on, and it is actually quite sensitive, so you don't have to walk over to it and yell at it. But okay, and it is running. So for the recorder, it's August 30th, 2017, and we're here to talk about the Class 1 petition for the LaPlatte Wetlands, which are on these maps that were provided by the petitioner today. My name is Laura LaPierre. I'm with the Vermont Wetlands Program. I'm the manager for the program. Tina Heath here is the district ecologist for Chittenden County and works in this area of the state. The purpose of this meeting primarily is to receive comments today verbally. There's going to be an extended time period for folks to also give written comments. So if you don't have any comments today, that's okay. We're accepting comments until the close of business September 13th. So that's on the notice materials that are provided up on our website. So today, this is a very interesting project because this is the first Class 1 petition that the Agency of Natural Resources has received since the agency has the ability to do rulemaking. So this is very different for us. And also a very interesting wetland for us to discuss. Besides receiving comments, we will be, I'll explain what the wetland regulations mean. So what does Class 1 wetland mean compared to Class 2 status, which the LaPlatte Wetlands currently has? To give you a bit more background, we're receiving, we have a sign-in sheet. We have a couple of people who have decided that they want to give verbal comments. If you haven't checked that off, that's okay. It looks like there'll be time to go around, and if you raise your hand, you can come up and give a comment. So this is the first comment period for the petition. Through the process of making a wetland Class 1, we actually have to go through formal rulemaking to amend the Vermont Wetland Rules. So this is early in the process. Right now, the Agency of Natural Resources has been given a petition from the NRC to decide whether or not we should pursue rule change. So after this public comment period, Tina and I are going to go through all of the comments we've received and create a responsiveness summary. Today we're going to try to answer as many questions as we can right here, but there may be some more complicated ones which we'll need to go back, look at the petition, and have a more formal and complete answer. So we'll do our best today. After we receive all the comments, we will be compiling that, reviewing the petition and making a recommendation to the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, and she will be deciding whether to deny the petition or to move the petition forward into rulemaking. Once rulemaking begins, there's another comment period and also the ability to go to a hearing as well. So there's still, if the petition moves forward, I just want to make it clear that there's another continuation of the process, which can take 6 to 9 months to complete. So, you know, after this meeting, it's not a matter of a month that the wetland may become Class 1. There's still a process for the decision making. Does anyone have any questions on the process or what the purpose of today is before I continue? Yes?
Well, There are other Class 1 wetlands.
Yes.
And not, so if they didn't go through this process, how did they get that classification?
So in the past, the Natural Resources Board did the Class 1 designations. There are three others that have received Class 1 designation this April. And that was through the agency through rulemaking. So that's how those were decided.
But you said something about this being the first.
Yes, this is the first time we've received a petition. So those three, we, as an agency, decided to move those forward as Class 1 because we believe that they were exemplary and unique to Vermont's natural heritage. So I'm just going to take a moment to explain what the regulation is. BNRC, the petitioner, has asked to also do a presentation on what their petition is so that people can get a better understanding of what that is. I want to ask, though, is there anybody who has to head out quickly who would like to submit comments now? Or is everyone able to stay for another 15 minutes or so before giving comment? Looks like everyone's good. Okay. Just want to make sure, because I know you all have you know, other things to be doing, and thank you for coming on such a beautiful day. So Class 1 wetlands receive the highest level of protection in the state of Vermont. There's more seats up front here if you guys would like to come in and sit down. And those are the wetlands that are considered exemplary or irreplaceable in the state. So if a portion of that wetland or that wetland was destroyed, we wouldn't be able to create it elsewhere and have it have the same functions or values for the state of Vermont. And they're really wetlands that are important to Vermont's natural heritage. So currently we have six wetlands that are Class 1. That's about a bit over 2,000 acres of wetland that's considered Class 1. And the permitting standards, so in order to do an activity within a wetland, it either needs to be considered an allowed use or you need to obtain a permit to do that work. And for Class 2 wetlands, we're looking for a standard of no undue adverse effect on the functions or values of that wetland. So if a wetland's really important for flood storage, we'd want to make sure that the project wasn't harming flood storage. And if it did, you would compensate for that elsewhere to create storage. For Class 1 wetlands, an additional standard has been added where you also can only receive a permit if that project is for a compelling need to meet public health or safety. So say, you know, there needs to be an evacuation route, something like that, or a utility needs to be upgraded, something like that. We actually haven't issued any permits for impacts within Class 1 wetlands historically for the 25 years the program's been in existence. And I have a handout up there if anyone's interested on what I'm explaining, so you can go back at home and read this in more detail. So Class 1 wetlands by default receive a 100-foot buffer zone. So that, again, is the second difference between Class 2 and Class 1, is there's a higher permitting standard, and then the buffer zone increases in size. And that buffer zone, you need a permit to do activities in that area as well, unless it's considered an allowed use. So I have, on this sheet, have the list of activities that are considered allowed uses so that you can look and see what sort of if you're a landowner, what sort of property you can, what sort of things you can do on your property without a permit. But you can receive permits for work in a buffer zone. All federal and state exemptions to the wetland rules still apply for Class 1 wetlands. So, say there's an exemption for growing food or crop for farming production. That exemption still applies within for the wetland rules. The rules just don't, are the food and crop is exempt, so you can continue to farm land that is in rotation. Tree harvesting is another one that we've received questions about for other Class 1 designations. If you'd like to harvest trees within wetland or buffer zone, you would need to get a plan approved by Forest Parks and Recreation in order to do so. So that's the basics of what Class 1 wetland means to regulations. There's certainly other meanings to the Class 1 designation. It means that it's one of the best wetlands in the state if it becomes Class 1 status. It's really recognizing those important functions and values. So, BNRC, would you like to just
that'd be great.
Say a few words about your petition?
Yeah, thanks, Laura. Appreciate it. So, my name is John Grobman. I'm the Policy and Water Program Director for BNRC with the Vermont Natural Resources Council. Just to let you know who we are and what our organization does. So we're Vermont's oldest and largest environmental advocacy group. We've been around for over 50 years. We work on protecting and enhancing the quality of Vermont's waters and forests and our vibrant communities and working land. And part of our work, BNRC has always been protecting wetlands. It's something that we've always been involved with. And wetlands, just to state the obvious, it's great to see everybody who's come out. But wetlands, as Laura is saying, they're really vital ecological resources. They provide a number of functions and values that are really crucial to protecting Vermont's environment. And just a few are water quality protection or flood storage. I think Laura mentioned that. Wildlife habitat, often rare species of vegetation are in wetlands. So they're very important ecologically. And as Laura is saying, in Vermont, we basically have two classes of wetlands that are protected under the wetland rules, Class 2 and Class 1. And so the Class 1 petition, as Laura was saying, really recognizes our most special wetlands that we have in Vermont. And really the main criteria that you really need to prove with the petition is that the functions and values in the wetland rules, that a wetland is exceptional or irreplaceable for some of those functions to Vermont's natural heritage. There are a couple ways, as Laura was saying, that a wetland could be designated as Class 1. ANR could, on its own, basically go through the same petition process and go through the functions and values and go through a public process just like this. When it identifies wetlands that it wants to see as Class 1, and ANR did that recently with several wetlands. But the wetland rules recognize that any person could actually petition for a wetland to be designated as Class 1. BNRC, as part of our work, we have been involved with several Class 1 petitions over the 50-plus years of BNRC being in existence, although the wetland rules have not been around as long as 50 years. Right? But so, for example, VNRC was the petitioner for the North Shore wetland in Burlington, where the Winooski River, the confluence of the Winooski River and Lake Champlain by the bike path, that's a Class 1 wetland. VNRC was the petitioner for that wetland designation. And to answer the question why, so I think what Laura's saying is different is that A&R did not have the authority, the petition didn't used to go to A&R. It used to go to another entity that would make a decision on the petition. And you didn't actually have to go through rulemaking. They would make the decision, and they would grant the petition or not. And you know, if they granted the petition, then the wetland was designated. Now there's an extra step of if the petition is granted, then the agency will proceed with rulemaking. But essentially, it's the same criteria. And I guess that's really what I want to stress is that, I've received a number of calls over the last few weeks since the petition was noticed and from people who own property who are wondering, well, what does this mean for my property? And those are very valid concerns, and I try to answer those questions to the best of my ability. I've said, really, the state is the final arbiter of those decisions about what this designation means for individual property owners. But essentially, the criteria is this wetland irreplaceable and exceptional for some of the functions and values, but actually only one of the 10 functions and values in the wetland rules. And if it is, then it deserves the Class 1 designation. I'm going to allow our consultants, Arrowwood Environmental, to come up. We hired Arrowwood to basically do the scientific evaluation of the functions and values, and I'd like for Dory or Michael to come up and kind of go through their analysis. But the last thing I'll say is that there are 10 functions and values in the wetland rules, and the plat is exceptional and irreplaceable in our opinion, in the opinion of our consultants, and the NRC for 9 of the 10. This is a very special resource in this community. You're really lucky to have it. And really the point of this petition is to basically afford this resource the protection that it really deserves under the law, and to recognize how we should go about in Vermont making sure that we don't lose the special values of the La Platte. So with that, I'll turn it over to these guys and we go through the functions and values.
Thank you, John. My name is Dory Garten. One of my partners, Michael Lou Smith. We both work with Arrowwood Environmental. We're a Vermont-based consulting firm. Michael and I have combined experience of over 40 years of evaluating and identifying wetlands in the state of Vermont. I give you that by way of background in terms of our task in this project, which was to identify what makes this wetland unique and special and irreplaceable. So we come to that task with quite a few years of experience tromping around the state and looking at a lot of different wetlands. So our job was to identify a boundary for the Class 1 designation or petition area, and then to evaluate the significance of the wetland within that boundary. Give you a little bit of basic information, which is really to orient you before we launch into the results of our work. So here we have the what we're calling tonight the La Platte River Marsh Wetland Complex, which is being petitioned for Class 1 designation. This map is oriented with north up. So we have Shelburne Bay at the northern corner of the map, and then they have the La Platte River, which actually flows in a northerly direction, and then we have McCabe Brook that also flows into Shelburne Bay. And just to orient you a little with the roads and kind of what defines this study area, we have the Route 7 corridor here, kind of have a boundary at the bottom here. This is Irish Hill Road, which is about the terminus of the area for the La Platte River. And then this road over here is Harbor Road, and this is Bay Road at the top. Our analysis involved both remote review of available databases and resources. There's been a wealth of information that's been collected over the years for this area, and it was our job to sift through all of that, as well as to conduct field evaluations of our own in terms of evaluating the significance of the wetland. I'm going to quickly turn this over to Michael to talk about the mapping and getting into the functions and values.
Yeah, there's been a lot of questions about the boundary of the map and how we come up with that and what that means. The boundary, just from the outset, is really, the boundary that we have on a map is really for planning purposes, right? And I'll talk more about this later. But what we did is we looked at recent ortho photographs, and we also created the digital elevation model so we can see where all the bumps and valleys are on the landscape, and came up with a boundary, what we think is the boundary of the Platte River Marsh wetlands. There's other map wetlands. There's other maps of wetlands. Most significantly, the Vermont Significant Wetlands Inventory map, which some of you may be aware of, which is also a map for planning purposes only. This differs from that map in a couple of ways. Because we kind of pinpointed this area, we were able to spend some time here. The boundary of this is, I think, a little more accurate than that. You'll also, if you look at them, overlay them, you'll also see that the Vermont Significant Wetlands Inventory map actually maps a lot more wetland than this map does. For example, this entire area is all mapped as wetland, as well as this area over here that we didn't include. Okay. I want to be clear about the actual boundary, that it is for planning purposes only. The actual regulatory boundary is really only determined in the field by someone who does a wetland delineation. Okay, so this is really for planning purposes. Right? And the advantage of having a more accurate boundary is that as a landowner, I think you have a more accurate idea about where that wetland line might be. Okay? There's been a lot of talk about functions and values of the wetlands, and we're going to dive in a little bit into that quickly, mainly because that's kind of the meat of the whole proposal, the whole petition. Functions and values are really a way that we assess and we evaluate how important wetlands are. Okay? And not all wetlands are created equally. There's, like Dory was mentioning, we've seen a lot of wetlands across the state. And some of them, you get to one and you're like, meh, you know, sometimes it's hard to find that it's significant for any function and value. Sometimes you'll find wetlands that you can check off, okay, this one's significant for, you know, flood storage, erosion control. And you're like, okay, got that set. And maybe in a rare case, you'll have something that is significant for, you know, 4 or 5. Okay? In a very rare case, something significant for all 10. Right? And this is one of those cases. Just to stress that this is very unusual to have a wetland of this size in this condition that performs all of the functions of value. Okay? And is significant for all of them. Is exemplary for 9 out of 10. Okay. So let's just go through some of these quickly. We're going to kind of tag team on some of the functions and values.
So as John was talking about earlier, one of the functions that we look at is flood storage. This is a large wetland. This is approximately 276 acres that we're looking at. It holds a lot of water. There's a lot of water moving through it, and it has the capacity to store a lot of flood waters. During significant rainfall events. And when we talk about that, what's unique about this situation is the relationship with the lake, and which makes this irreplaceable, we use that word, and exemplary. So we have floodwaters that come through the La Platte River watershed and McCabe's Brook. The La Platte River watershed is approximately 50 square miles. There's a lot of water that drains through this area and moves through this wetland, which has 14 different natural community types. We're looking at floodplain forests, shrubs, swamps, and marshes that are all essentially containing this water that moves through the watershed, but also during significant storm events or high flow times, such as like Irene, we see a backwater that comes from the lake and essentially takes advantage of this storage area for the La Platte. And this map over here, the reason why I brought this map was to give you an indication of what happens actually during flood changes in the lake. And so essentially, I know this is hard to see, but what we did here is we modeled the storage capacity of these wetlands at different points of lake levels. And so if you kind of track this through, you can see the black is essentially the water that's backflowing from the lake. And we went from elevation of 96, when the lake level's 96 feet, to 98 feet, to 100 feet, to 102 feet. And so you get a sense of the capacity this wetland has and the significance in terms of, you know, lakeshore properties. And we can't all, we've all been hearing the last 2 days the significance of wetlands during events across the country. So that's one of the functions and values that we look at. Hand in hand with that is surface and groundwater quality protection. So this large wetland that serves as a large filter for surface waters that are moving through the watershed. The La Platte River, upper reaches of the La Platte River, flows through and contains a lot of agricultural land. And so there's a lot of runoff that's headed towards the La Platte, and as I'm sure most of you know living in this area, into Shelburne Bay, which is having, which suffers from high nutrient levels. So this wetland is one of the last lines of defense before entry into Shelburne Bay. And the unique assemblage of wetlands that are present are essentially filtering nutrient-laden waters before entering into the bay. And, can wetlands be overmaxed? Yeah, they can. Is the bay clean? No, it's not. This wetland is not, isn't the only line of protection. But without it, would things be a lot worse? Yes. Guaranteed.
Another one of the functions is fish habitat, and anybody who likes to fish knows that these marsh wetlands, especially attached to Lake Champlain, are incredibly important for spawning fish habitat. There was a recent survey by ANR that documented 23 different fish species in those plots, and two of which are rare species. Hand in hand with that is wildlife habitat. Wetlands that are important for wildlife habitat are structurally diverse. And that means they've got trees, they've got shrubs, they've got herbaceous vegetation, they've got open water, and it's all intermixed. Okay, that kind of wetland supports a wide variety of wildlife. Okay? And that's exactly what we have here. Okay, hundreds of species of birds, 20 species of mammals. It just... 23 species of fish, 20 species of mammals, and 100 species of birds. Okay, mink, otter, beaver. The structure and the placement of this wetland make it incredibly important for wildlife habitat. Dory also mentioned natural communities. There's 14 different natural community types. 3 different types of floodplain forests, buttonbush swamps, deep bulrush marshes, shallow emergent marshes. Okay? And many of these are what are considered state significant natural communities. The floodplain forests that kind of stretch all along the banks here is actually an uncommon community in the state. It used to be along all our major rivers, but it makes really good cropland. So most of them have been converted. And so finding large intact examples of this community is pretty rare. And that's what we have here. And that's why they're exemplary for this natural community function. Another one is if the wetland is used for education or research. Well, we know lots of school groups go here. We also know that University of Vermont takes school groups here. We know that there's research that goes on here from the universities. Nonprofit organizations use this as outreach and education. So it's a widely used weapon for education and research.
And just to wrap up quickly, because we could really go on for a long time, there's a lot about this wetland that's special. And actually, I suspect that most of you already are familiar with this wetland and have reasons why you think it's special too. But recreation. I just went out this last weekend with my family to get reoriented and come into here fresh. I don't live in this watershed. And I just watched my 13-year-old amazed by the wildlife and the access that she had. We pulled a canoe over. We knew it was public land.
We knew she could get out, she could tromp around in the mud if she wanted to, looking at the painted turtles, going into the floodplain forest, talking to the anglers that were in their kayaks, talking to the bird watchers. It's a phenomenal place. A lot of it is publicly owned, either by the town or by nonprofit organizations. And this is pretty unique for such a large wetland resource to be able to get in there and to enjoy it. And people are doing it at a very large rate. Every time people out, we see a lot of people. So I won't spend too much time. I think everyone knows that this is an incredible resource for recreation. And part of that reason is because of all of the natural features that are there and its association with the lake. The last important function is erosion control. That has a lot to do with the intact nature of the forest and the communities on the banks of the La Platte River. I mean, this wetland essentially it forms the shoreline of this river, and it's holding the soils in place. And you can compare that with what's going on in the upper La Platte, and that's just not the case in the locations where the forests have been converted to farmland. So I think in looking at what's so exemplary about this wetland, a lot of it has to do with the location and the uniqueness of that, and that's why it's not replaceable. We can't move this wetland or create a wetland somewhere else and recreate the same situation that we have there.
Sorry,
we took a little longer.
I'm a little excited about it.
All right, so a few more people just came in. I want to let you know that there's a sign-in sheet over here. We have a place for you to check off whether or not you want to give a verbal comment today. We'll be going through and asking people to come up and give their comment in order of the check marks, and then we'll have more time if people just want to raise their hand and give comment later too. So if you haven't signed in, please sign in. And the town select board would like to come up and give some comments and welcome.
With your permission, I'd like to sit.
Okay, the microphone works.
Thank you. My name is Jerry Story. I'm a member of the Shelburne Select Board, on the behalf of which Susan Neckenberg, sitting next to me, represents the Shelburne Natural Resources and Conservation Committee, will remark on the proposed reclassification of the La Platte wetland. The town recognizes the environmental benefits of the reclassification and supports Vermont Natural Resources Council proposal in concept. The town identifies problematic aspects to reclassification and anticipates further examination and discussion of these with the agency and other relevant organizations. We will submit written comments by the 13th, and once again appreciate the extension of that deadline. As host, I wish to welcome everyone who's participating and attending this hearing, and we thank you greatly for your effort in putting it on. And with that, I'm going to introduce Susan.
My name is Susan Neckenberg. I'm a member, as Jerry said, of the Shelburne Natural Resources and Conservation Committee. I have a PhD in ecology, and I've been authorized to speak on behalf of the town on this matter by both my committee and the select board. On behalf of the town of Shelburne, I would like to welcome the Agency of Natural Resources, the Vermont Natural Resources Council, and the consultants from Arrowwood Environmental to our town, and we thank you for your time. We also thank the agency for extending the deadline to the 13th to allow the select board the opportunity to discuss and ultimately formalize its written comments on behalf of the town at its next regular meeting, which is scheduled for September 12th. We in Shelburne are fortunate to have the La Platte River and the wetland complex as part of our natural heritage. To live near and enjoy a place so beautiful, exceptional, and irreplaceable is something we treasure. The La Platte wetland complex exceeds many of the criteria of values and functions for a Class 1 wetland, as you've just heard. It is home to a documented 22 rare, threatened, and endangered species. It is a haven for bird watchers. Its many varied and special plant communities make it biologically and functionally diverse. It's many varied and the wetlands surrounding the La Platte River, the largest river to flow into Shelburne Bay, provides natural filtration for the source of drinking water for many residents of the Champlain Valley. And the wetland also provides a sponge-like buffer at times when Lake Champlain reaches flood stages, as we saw during Tropical Storm Irene and other recent floods. The town of Shelburne supports the petition to reclassify the Platte wetland to a Class 1 wetland in concept. I've had the opportunity to speak with and ask questions of Mr. Grodman and Mr. Shoup, the executive director of the NRC, and Ms. LaPierre of the ANR. We and others in town, however, continue to have questions we hope to have answered. So I'm going to go through those now. It's about time. What impacts would reclassification have on town properties, including the wastewater treatment plant, the salt storage shed, and the rescue facilities on Turtle Lane and on the Bay Road Bridge? Number two, what, if any, implications would the reclassification have in the event of an accidental discharge from the wastewater treatment facilities? Number three, what, if any, support or compensation can existing property owners expect should conditions require alteration of their property? For example, an existing home with a cellar leak or a stormwater mitigation need or a septic problem. Number four, what would reclassification mean for existing and future walking paths and trails? Number five, we know the La Platte does move and causes erosion. Wetlands are dynamic ecosystems. If in the future we get more concerned about this and want to do some bank side planting to prevent erosion or some other similar problem, how will these efforts be affected? Some towns have gone to great extents with rivers and streams to re-engineer them to control such movement. What if we decide property owners are under such a severe threat that such re-engineering is vitally necessary? How would such an effort be affected? How will Lambersite efforts in the La Platte River be affected, or efforts against other invasives? Number seven, the water in the La Platte is burdened with a great deal of silt and sediment. What if some effort to clean and filter these waters upstream from Lake Champlain were ever proposed? Could that be done? Number eight, will storm outlets that send storm water to the La Platte ever be regulated? If they lie outside the buffer, can Class 1 wetland water quality permitting be applied to them? What about agricultural water flows? Number nine, would the reclassification affect the potential dredging at the mouth of the La Platte River, which has been discussed by the boating club located there? Number 10, if questions remain after this hearing, will you commit to scheduling an additional information session in Shelburne? Thank you again for your time and for your effort. We're happy to submit these questions in writing to incorporate your review. Answers to these questions will allow the town to submit more meaningful written comments regarding the petition to reclassify the wetland. We will do all we can to work with the agency between now and September 13th to continue this important dialogue and ensure everyone is working with the most accurate information.
Thank you. So I got as many of those questions down on the piece of paper. I'll certainly respond in writing once we receive the official town comments, but I'd like to just respond to some of those which I can right now. So the salt shed, many of you are familiar with how that is actually a federally exempt activity, which does not,
She was referring to the town's salt shed.
Oh, the town's salt shed. Okay, thank you.
Some might refer to the other salt shed,
right,
but we're talking about the town salt shed.
You are, okay. Well, if anyone has, for the record, for the other salt shed, that's something that's federally exempt, and this classification change doesn't make a difference. I'll have to look up where the town salt shed is to give more of an answer there. Impacts to Class 1 wetlands, which are not considered an allowed use that require a permit, can still occur if they're for public health and safety. So I heard a concern about if there's erosional issues where folks' buildings are falling in the river, and I think that's a health and safety issue that the state would want to address. Dealing with invasive species is something that is an allowed use so long as A&R can approve the plan. This is something that I receive on a regular basis for like invasive plants. You receive plans for spot treatments of those species or cutting and pulling. Those are all things that we can look at and approve. We want to minimize the effects of the effects that may have to the function of the wetland, but we see that as restoration and something that's a good thing, and we wouldn't want to prevent that from happening. The lamprosite treatment is also considered an invasive that would be controlled with a plan approved by A&R. So talking about cleaning up waters, that's a restoration effort. Anything that's restoring river function or wetland function is something that can be approved with a plan submitted to A&R. So beneficial type activities, there is a route for those activities to occur. Future walking trails. We do have an allowed use for boardwalks. I would imagine this wetland is quite wet, so you'd probably want a boardwalk instead of walking through the actual wetland with the path. We have a BMP, a best management practice, that describes exactly what sort of boardwalks can go in and be considered an allowed use. And I think at this point, I'll take the rest of the comments and respond in writing, but you had a follow-up question?
Is that okay?
Yeah.
There are three pretty significant town properties that I was referring to. The town salt storage shed, the town, one of the town's wastewater treatment plants, and the town rescue building that are all adjacent to each other. And I can show you where they are on the map, if that would help.
Yeah, certainly. Another thing to reiterate as well, you can come up while I'm speaking, is that existing structures can be maintained under an allowed use. So if you have a structure and it's within the Class 1 wetland or the buffer zone, it's essentially grandfathered in. You don't have to remove that building or driveway or whatnot. If you wanted to expand it, that would be something that would require a permit. But if you're maintaining, painting your building, continuing agricultural use, those are all things that can continue to occur if this wetland became Class 1.
So the facilities I just referred to are on Turtle Lake, and it looks like the rescue is adjacent to the 100-foot buffer, but a portion of the wastewater treatment facility and all of the salt storage shed fall within the what would be the extended buffer.
Okay.
And they're right, so they're right here.
Before, were they outside of the 50-foot buffer, do you know?
I believe so.
Or
mm-hmm.
currently
I believe
they are.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So
Susan, could you point those out again for all of us?
Oh,
just put them aside and so we can see exactly what you're talking
about. All right, so community school. So Turtle Lane is over here across the street, right?
Yeah.
And so, wastewater treatment, I think. And salt, the salt shed should be right over here. No, this is the salt shed. And this is rest.
So, something that Michael and Dory were mentioning is that the mapping is for planning purposes, and in the end, what matters is where the wetland actually is. They may have, with aerial interpretation, overmapped or called some area as potentially class one wetland, and if we went on the ground and saw that there was no wetland there, we wouldn't regulate it as wetland. It's only if it actually exists there. So I suppose one thing that we could do for the town is do a site visit and see exactly where the wetland boundary is and where that 100-foot buffer would be in relation to those buildings. And we can talk about the details of what permitting would be required. And I'd like to offer that to anybody else who's a landowner as well. We'd be happy to go out to the site and talk about your specific concerns.
We greatly appreciate that. That's a nice offer.
So next here on the list is Susan Smith. Did you want to make a comment?
No.
No, okay. So this check mark is below your name. So that's Brian Freeport.
Thanks, Brian. I'm Brian Precourt. My family owns the Shelburne Shopping Park right in the village. I'm here because of the wetland that we own in conjunction with the Shelburne Wood Trailer Park, which is behind the Aubuchon Hardware Store. We're asking that that 2-acre wetland continue to be designated as Class 2 wetland with a 50-foot buffer. That wetland was characterized as having limited wetland functions and values just recently. We purchased the shopping park in September of 2010. Around that time, or shortly before that time, there was a great deal of planning and board work that was done for the trailer park and what became Harrington Place. There were quite a few meetings. So when we bought it, there had been quite a bit of delineation that had already been done. When we purchased that property, that wetland was designated Class 3. Shortly after that, we began to look at plans to do some development in the shopping park. And in 2012, we had it delineated. And it was the person that did the delineation said it was Class 2 wetland. And he felt Class 2, and so it was with a required 50-foot buffer. I think there's a number of reasons why I feel that the designation shouldn't change. This wetland was created by four discharge pipes. Three of the discharge pipes are from the shopping park. One is from the town of Shelburne. Virtually all of the stormwater in the center of town pours into there, right in the center, all those culverts. I had my surveyor look at the delineation as compared to what we had done, what the petitioners had done for their delineation. And I think what he saw was that a lot of the delineation, at least down at this end, was being done with the floodplain maps, or it sort of mirrored, which I think the board should look at closely, because those floodplain maps were revised recently. And they're using an elevation of 120 as the outside edge of the delineation for a floodplain. And if anybody is wondering if that's correct, he printed off a FEMA map, and the red line delineates the floodplain, and it's 120 feet. So the lake level would have to be at 120 feet. I'm going to read this. So I think the board should look at the delineation. I know you had said that it was done for planning purposes, but as I said, I had the surveyor and our wetland people looking at it, and we couldn't get things to jog. We had a delineation done in the field, and when you take the petitioners, that 100-foot buffer actually goes further into our property and hits some of the buildings. So I'm glad to hear that at least the board is going to look at the petitioner's delineation, because I think there are some significant problems. At least that's what the two experts that we hired to take a look at it. I think one of the other significant things is with this little bulb right here, there's a significant elevation change from the little plot. That wetland, the base of the wetland, is 30 to 35 feet above the bank of the little plot. The buffer zone, which is around the side of Aubuchon and goes all the way up to, if you do the 100 feet, goes all the way up to the back of the Shelburne Country Store, would actually be parts of the Shelburne Country Store right in the village. That's up around 160. So you're talking about 60 feet above this floodplain elevation that they're looking to protect. So I think when we did our permitting, in 2016, or before that, we had been working to put an addition on the back of the Rite Aid. In that process, it was about a 5,000 square foot addition. In that process, we had to install a storm detention pond in the back of the Ocean building. A section of that pond we had to get a wetland permit. A section of the pond is on previously disturbed wetland buffer. And that pond is big enough for just the addition. In 2016, we did receive a permit from the Agency of Natural Resources, a Vermont wetland permit for the 5,000 square foot addition. And in that permit, the agency agreed that this was a self-contained 2-acre wetland, not contiguous to other wetlands, and the permit was given on that determination. It was found to have limited wetland functions and values. So that's a relatively, within a year, that's what this section of the petitioner's request was recently done. My engineer is Ben Keith, her husband, so I couldn't use her, he ain't gonna be involved with. On our property, and I've done another one map that I've given you. On our property, if the change in designation were to go through, the only thing that would change is additional buffer. Well, the additional buffer that's being requested would be the current stormwater detention basin, parking, driving, the roads, parking, and mowed lawns. I've also taken some pictures of what would become Class 1 buffer. And that's the storm detention system that was put in. As I mentioned, the stormwater detention system that we had to put in last year was just put in large enough for the addition and the impervious surface that surrounds that addition. I wanted to dig the pond because in the near future, we're going to be required to provide stormwater treatment for the entire shopping park. I wanted to dig the pond big enough for the entire park so that we could get it over all at once. My engineer checked with the state, and they said, no, you can't do that. Since the rules haven't been written, you could put in something that's wrong, so that was not allowed. So in the near future, I'm going to have to enlarge that stormwater detention basin. And if it is in Class 1, and you said they've never given a permit in Class 1, that makes it almost impossible for them. So,
for impacts within the wetland itself, is our activities that need to be for a compelling need for public health and safety, but the buffer zone is not, doesn't have that standard. It's a similar standard as a Class 2 wetland buffer zone. It's just an expanded buffer zone where we're reviewing what's current within 100 feet, so 50 feet.
So you have given permits in the buffer zone. You have never given a permit in the wetland.
Correct.
When we were permitting this, and this was determined to be of limited, this wetland was determined to be of limited limited wetland functions. We still had to, even though it was Class 2 and Class 2 buffer, we still had to really minimize our impact in this disturbed area. None of that back there where we were working is virgin soil. It's all been filled over the years. So the wetland people still made us pull out. I don't know if that's going to be possible with Class 1. I don't know. So that's our concern. I think, I'm hoping that the board will look at a recent permit and a recent determination and remove this section from it.
Yeah, we'll certainly look at that decision.
Okay.
And review this particular area for designation. Because whether or not it should be a part of the designation.
Because they did look at the delineation that they have on this map is not the field delineation. It's different. It's larger. So I don't know if that's just in this area or in other areas, but we did have our section of this wetland delineated. The trailer park may have had theirs done, but ours was field delineated and approved by the state. There's a copy of my comments.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, and the next commenter, I'm going to check on making sure that the recorder's still going and see if anyone else has questions over there. Can you read the next name?
Yeah, Gordon Russell, if you'd like to come up. And
A lot of my questions would have been answered by what she said. My only thoughts about it is that it's already protected by a Class 2 wetland. I'm not really sure what the reclassification to a Class 1 is going to protect it even more, but you're just going to expand the buffers, which would take more of the property owner's rights away? Is that how I'm understanding this?
So it is expanding the buffer zone. So the state would be reviewing a larger area of land where being adjacent to the wetland, activities within 100 feet could certainly affect those functions and values of the wetland. And so it's allowing for a greater area of review. That's correct. However, the buffer zone can go through the same permitting requirements as a Class 2 wetland permitting requirement.
Oh, so anybody in the buffer zone can still be zoned under Class 2 as opposed to the Class 1? Is that what you're saying?
It's a similar review as a Class 2 for getting permits, but the area is enlarged.
Okay, so the area is enlarged.
If
I'm within that 100-foot buffer, I'm going to be looking at as a class being under the Class 1 wetland.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the area is not going to be protected anymore. I mean, than what it already is, right? Only my property rights and that 100 5-foot buffer zone is now going to be diminished. Is that correct?
So the concept of buffer zones is that there's, you know, 100 ways that you can degrade or harm a wetland, and only 2 of those activities really occur within the wetland itself, dredging and draining that wetland. There's a lot of things that you can do in the adjacent area of wetland that can harm the functions and values. So, for example, wildlife really need, they really need that transitional zone between the wetland and the upland area. There are many species that actually nest in the buffer zone. And by allowing that area to have, if it does have forested area, to help it remain that way, then that's adding value to that wetland.
But that's already protected now. The wildlife is already there. The protection, the Class 2 is already there. The property itself, I'm sure, is owned by that nonprofit. Natural owns the property. So what more protection are you giving by reclassifying this as a Class 1 as opposed to the Class 2 and the protection that it has right now? It isn't like... other than taking the value of the properties within that 100-foot buffer and extending that, what protection in that wetland are you really going to increase? Because it's already there. It's already as a Class 2. No, you know.
Yeah, and the wetland rules are set up to maintain the functions and values of that wetland. So doing this classification, you're right, we're not going, the state isn't going to go into these wetlands and have a prescriptive number of things that we're going to go in and do for this wetland. But there's an understanding that activities that occur next to or within the wetland could degrade those functions. So we have it. We definitely have a wetland that has functions and values today, and if we can maintain its integrity, we'll have that off into the future. But I'll certainly respond to your comment in greater detail in writing.
All right.
Thank you. Okay, next comment is Andrea Morgant. Did I say that right?
Yeah. Okay. I'm here on behalf of the Lewis Creek Association, and which is a watershed organization that works both in Lewis Creek watershed and in the La Platte. We do water quality monitoring, work with landowners, and have done extensive monitoring using protocols established by DEC, through the La Rosa Lab, and have data going back in some places 20 years. We want to speak in favor of this recent reclassification. What we've learned as citizens concerned about the environment and water quality is that wetlands are just vital for all of the reasons that we have the regulations, and we see that increasing that buffer to 100 feet would further protect, and it's certainly those activities that do happen with the buffer that greatly affect the wetlands. We've done a lot of work in terms of land conservation and stormwater research upstream and at the headwaters of the La Platte, where we've been able to protect greater areas of land around what were degraded wetlands, former agricultural land, a lot of land that had been dredged. And over time, we're, as an organization, working with other nonprofits and land conservation organizations, really trying to protect as much of the river corridor in the La Platte as we can. Shelburne is in a unique position here as the town where this amazing wetland exists, for not only the benefit of Shelburne residents, but people come from all over
and are able to enjoy and appreciate that. So we recognize that the town and landowners have many concerns, and I'm confident that the state will work to address those, but we really do support and recognize that a 100-foot buffer would improve protection.
Frank Talbot.
So this is my wife, Michaela Ryan. We together, we own Ryan Talbot Farm Enterprises, which is New Village Farm. We, our property goes about 100 acres. It goes from here all the way down to here. Michael started this farm 9 years ago on someone else's property. And the reason she did is because it's within walking distance for probably 1,000 or more children.
School
children. Shelburne Community School and Champlain Waldorf School. Her farming operation now consists of, at least the physical plant, consists of a barn, a greenhouse, a shed here that's right now used for housing chickens, a wash-up shed, farm stand. Right now, this designation encapsulates their entire physical plant within the 100-foot I know that it has been said several times that farming is exempt and agriculture is exempt. If you really read the rules, the only thing that is exempt is the growing of crops.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that means that her entire business operation, which has served 852,000 families over the last 9 years, is going to be put out of business.
I mean, I don't know that it is, but it doesn't qualify right now. Like, we have a building that's dedicated to selling food that we grow on farms. But selling food is not allowed in the buffer. Cleaning and processing food is not allowed in the buffer. Growing food is allowed. So, and the other big part of what we do, having chosen this site close to school children, is education. So farming education, as I understand, is not allowed in the buffer, but wetland education is allowed. So it really kind of, and then this area, this ditch, if you will, that causes the farm structures to go into this 100-foot buffer is a farm ditch that was actually dug by the previous landowner that it was in a space that wasn't designated. So he dug a farm ditch and two farm ponds, which has now been encompassed by this whole thing, which now put me entirely in the buffer. The new buffer, not the old.
And the other thing is that this little finger here is not actually mapped right now as Class 2 buffer. It shows up in the floodplain, but it's not mapped as Class 2 buffer. So
it's converted floodplain to Class 1.
Yeah, jumped from floodplain to Class 1. The aerial map we talked about from 2003 that you see on the Vermont Inventory of Significant Wetlands shows before all of this development happened, and you can verify that this ditch, this pond, that this ditch and these two ponds were not in existence.
So a few things to respond to. Thank you for submitting your comments. And I'd like to look into this a bit further. Certainly looking at the aerial photography and if allowed going out onto your site and seeing what, if that long skinny finger is contributing or if it's a ditch man-made feature. So, buildings and structures that are in existence today would be grandfathered into the Class 1 designation, and they can be maintained and kept in place. They don't need to be torn down. Anything new, any new structures or buildings would need a permit to place those within the buffer zone. thinking that this is a buffer zone that's in agricultural use. We'd be seeing if there's an area that's already disturbed where you could do that activity. So I think there's more flexibilities than nothing can happen in the buffer zone, and we should probably talk a bit earlier about that because you want so much of the land along the plot. So thank you.
Laura, can I comment on that?
Yes, there's a couple more commenters, but
it was just that, any more site-specific information that comes about or we have, I think, is really valuable in this process. When drawing those lines, we didn't visit, we visited only public land, and so there's a lot more information that we don't know, right? The other point I wanted to make was that I don't think that this boundary really changes your situation, because as I understand it right now, most of that field is mapped as on the Vermont Wetlands Significant Inventory map. And so most of that field right now is considered a Class 2 wetland.
Well, that's not true. This field here is mapped right up to about here is mapped as Class 2.
Right.
But it's not wetland because it's agriculture. It's crop, so it's technically not wetland, so there is no buffer zone.
So
and
we'll
even if you extend the 15-foot buffer zone, you get nowhere near our barn.
So we'll definitely
look
at those details. And this is what the petitioner is presenting. If, in fact, A&R decides to move the petition to a rule change, I would be most comfortable for those landowners who are coming forward with additional information. I would want to include that on any mapping that actually becomes official. So we can hash that out more outside of this meeting. So thank you. And we have Rose Paul. Would you like to make a comment?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm Rose Paul. I'm the director of new title, Science and Freshwater Programs with the Nature Conservancy in Vermont. I've been working for there for 18 years, and for that whole time, I have been responsible for the management of the lands the Nature Conservancy owns along the lower La Platte River. Our mission is to conserve the lands and waters on which all life depends. And we own 225 acres of land around the mouth of the La Platte River. We also hold about 130 acres of conservation easement in close proximity to those lands. And the conservation easement precludes development on those lands. That was an arrangement with willing landowners at the time. And it's an arrangement in perpetuity. Sorry, my notes are kind of messy. I think we probably own about half, maybe a third to the half, I haven't done a real analysis, of the wetlands under consideration with this Class 1 petition. We have recognized for a long time that this is a really special area, really special on a Vermont-wide basis. We knew that decades ago, and we started acquiring land in 1974. And we acquired the land parcel by parcel over the decades. It's slow work to conserve an intact ecosystem, and that's what we set our sights to do. I reviewed the application, the petition for Class 1, and as a biologist, as an ecologist, I agree with the information provided. I've been thinking about and keeping the information about this land for decades. So I agree with the information as presented. And the Nature Conservancy supports the petition. I'd like to say that my tenure on this land is just a very minute dot on the 10,000-year timeline of the lower La Platte ecosystem since the glaciers retreated. And it does hurt to see the several nets that have happened around the edges of nature conservancies ownership. We've had a small boundary trespass on our south side. We've had the threat of land condemnation on our south side. We've had land clearing on the east side of us. And now it appears that there's been land clearing above the special bobcat ledges on the east side of land that we own. So my management and tenure has been a dot on the timeline of this property. And in less than that dot, this property is starting to be eroded by adjoining land uses that aren't always respectful of the specialness of this place. And I'm saying this because I think Class 1 status can help retain the integrity and the intactness of this very special ecosystem. Just a few of activities that may not have come to light in the petition. I could go on for a long time, and I won't. But things that I've seen on my tenure, you know, we've had about 15 years of AmeriCorps members. These are usually young career folks interested in conservation, and they're getting hands-on training. And we actively manage our La Platte property. So we've had AmeriCorps members training early in their career, year after year, on this property. We go there and control invasive species. We monitor boundaries. We maintain the trail. We've had years of all kinds of classes, all kinds of grade levels, visiting our property because we do provide a mile walking trail. So we've had student projects that have created an interpretive brochure for the trail, an interpretive brochure for paddling up the La Platte. We've had budding artists from UVM create the lovely interpretive maps that are at the beginning of our walking trail. We've had all kinds of scientific inquiries from coyotes to turtles. I've got other examples that I can't find right now. It's been a kind of a soup to nuts training ground for young ecologists, biologists, scientists, young folks from Shelburne Farms coming out to get a taste of being out and in what appears to all of us visiting Chittenden and Kearney as wild nature, because you can always see wildlife when you visit the La Platte. Always. I guarantee it. The Nature Conservancy works in many ways. We influence public policy. We provide education. We provide public access. And we're best known for buying special natural areas and managing them. But even our ownership can't always keep things intact. What happens in the surrounding landscape and upstream affects the properties we own. So I'll say again, I think the Class 1 status with its proposed 100-foot buffer can help keep these very special lands intact. I know the petition talks about the ecosystem services that the wetlands of the lower La Platte offer. And I'd like to say to everyone that these wetlands are working for us. They're helping all of us filter stormwater from parking lots, from agricultural land. They're filtering out sediments and scrubbing out the phosphorus that's affecting our bays and supporting the blue-green algae growth on our bays. It's helping flood retention in times of high water. Believe me, I've paddled through the La Platte floodplain amongst the trees. You would think it's a forest, but for 3 to 4 weeks of the year, you can paddle through that forest because it is storing floodwater. The little nicks and cuts that happen to this beautiful area affect us spiritually. Many of us go there for tranquility and to connect with nature. And when you've got a looming development as you round the bend of the river in your boat, that's a spiritual nick and cut that I think is very real for people. So in conclusion, thank you. And I'd just like to say that we think the Class 1 will help prevent future nicks and cuts that our owners can't prevent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Charlie Burnham?
Coming over here just because I want to put something out of the map. I'm Charlie Brown. I'm here together with Ellen Clay and we own a house on the plot which was built by others in 1988. And I guess it's the first house you would ever see, somewhat surprisingly, when you put your kayak in the water and you go around the first bend of the river. And my God, there's a suburban house there. That is our home. So we call that, some people call that river house, whatever. It is the northernmost dwelling on the river. It's about here on this little map. It's actually very hard to see, but it's a dot. It appears to be in the river. And one of the subsidiary structures, we're not terribly fond of, but which was there when we got there, is actually built over the riverbank. So that is the property to the, to the west of us are our friends, the Nature Conservancy, that we just heard from. And, they're to the east. And to the west is the Shelburne Book Club, which has been there, I believe, since 1961. So we've owned this property for a little more than a decade. We are therefore downstream from all this activity and however various activities that might occur along the river would then affect us. We do not affect, as far as I know, by any runoff or anything that we do, what happens upstream, except perhaps in the case of this reverse flow that we heard about, so as that possible. But in general, we are the recipients of the river, and we are very privileged to live where we live. The legal description of our property, which rests in this building in a giant book down the hall, states in part that it is bound on the south by, quote, the center line of the LaPlante River, unquote. I don't know if this applies to other people who actually live on the river or own property on the river, but this was a description created by the estate of Lester Thompson in 1921. So actually, according to this description, we actually own the riverbed extending south from our property boundaries to the center of the river. to us, this means not that we own the river in any way, but that we bear a special shared responsibility for its use and care. That's how we interpret that particular description. But as a practical matter, we live, work, sleep, and eat inside the broadest part of the river every day. It's the last thing we see at dusk and the first thing we see at dawn. We're therefore perhaps impacted more than many others by what happens to the life of the river, and we're also well positioned to observe these impacts in an anecdotal and non-scientific way over time, and we're probably more than most people in town. Now I want to talk about something that happened today. I realize this is rambling a bit, but I was doing some roof repairs on my house. I had a commanding view of the river. So at 3:45, I saw a large blue heron rise from the marsh in front of me and head east up the river. And I could really hear the beat of its wings flew past about 20 feet away. 15 minutes later, a bright yellow jet ski appeared from the direction of the lake, going about 10 miles an hour. And that's the speed that we're accustomed to for power boats going up the river. It's a little slower for you kayakers, but we observed them, hundreds of them, over the course of the decade that we've lived there. They go right by basically our living room and lawn. But at 4:15, the same jet ski could be heard approaching at a much higher speed. He passed me going, what I would say, about 25 knots, which is even faster than 25 miles an hour, and he threw up a big wave right on the bank. So I concluded from that that his first pass was kind of a reconnaissance to see if there were any underwater obstructions, but his exit pass was as fast as he could possibly go and have some fun on the river. So I repeat that our house is 22 feet from the riverbank. That's the beginning of the slope down to the river. It's thus very clearly lies within the 50-foot buffer zone. About half of it does, I should say. I'll get to a little bit more on that in a minute. So it was built in 1988, and it could obviously not be built on that spot today, but it's too heavy to move. When we purchased our property more than a decade ago, we researched the deeds going back to the 1920s and the land use, which is thereabouts. There are a lot of unusual things about this northern part of the river. And it seemed to us that there had been more than the usual share of legal disputes and fights about various subdivisions and other land use issues. We were aware that our property lay, in part, within the 50-foot wetlands buffer zone defined by a Class 2 wetland. In fact, the 50-foot line appears to pass basically through the middle of the house. So before us today, we have a petition that would reclassify part of the La Platte River watershed as a Class 1 wetland. And I was interested in the presentation earlier because not much was discussed about this area below Harbor Road, which is clearly part of the watershed. I believe that's not in dispute, but was not delineated in the petition. And I thought, okay, so there's some room here for discussion about what is and what shouldn't be part of the delineation. In other words, some level of some algorithm, some arbitrary consideration has applied to how they've done this. Otherwise, it really would extend much further. Those of you who've been up that creek know, I've explored every part of the river, every bit of this, until I ran out of room at the falls. Over the years, because I can go kayaking every morning if I want. When we bought the property, we knew that it was a Class 2 wetland and that part of the house was in the buffer zone. We wanted to find out what that would mean, and then in this case, we wanted to find out really what the difference was as it moved from Class 2 to Class 1. And as we've heard, that turned out to be mostly a geographic difference. We don't live in the wetland exactly, but we live in the buffer zone, and now the buffer zone includes basically our entire parcel because we are bounded by this one here to our west, and our south is the river itself. And when you extend all of those things 100 feet, it includes everything that we own. So there is no activity that we can do that's a new activity that would not require the good offices of these folks in terms of submitting a plan, conducting studies, possibly hiring attorneys, and what have you. So going back to the events of my day, just for a moment, I wanted to see what the reclassification might mean to the blue heron or possibly the jet skier. So after reading the current statute, it appeared to me, not a lawyer, not a scientist, that the heron's lot would not be materially improved by the reclassification. And I say this because what I don't understand is if we're saying it's irreplaceable, and if we're saying it needs protection, what is the exact threat? We heard about nicks and cuts, but it seems like they're happening anyway. So are you now going to publicize this to the point where someone who's contemplating a nick or a cut would then not make the nick or cut? I can't see how the mechanism of protection actually affects the usages of the people who own property around here. That's my basic problem with this. What does it actually do in a practical sense? So when we have a new law, we change a speed limit, we do something in town, usually it's demonstrated what good this is going to do. In this case, it seems more like a recognition of the irreplaceable nature and the wonders of this place, which I obviously well know since I live within it. So I couldn't figure that out, but I'm sure that I will be educated. Then I came to the jet skier and I thought, how would he be affected? Well, I sure wish they would go slower or maybe not even be allowed up there, but I couldn't see anything in the statute that would allow anybody to say to those guys, no, it's just for kayakers or self-powered water vehicles. You can't bring a powerboat up. And a lot of our friends who are fishermen, of course, do have little boats with different kinds of motors. I myself own a boat with an electric motor. In some parts of the country, that would be regulated or not even allowed. I couldn't figure out how it would affect the jet skier. So the last person who was present this afternoon was me. So I thought, okay, how would this affect me? And I began to think about that. So I thought of a couple of examples. Under the Class 2, which we exist under now, we can't create any new structures or do much of anything without a state permit in the 50-foot zone, which is at the front, or rather the riverside of our property. We could, however, because that zone ends somewhere in the middle of the house, put up a shed or apply to the town to build a barn or a structure with a foundation in that part of our property. Under Class 1, we could not. It would then become up to the state to permit that. And I don't say that they wouldn't do it or we wouldn't present a good plan, but my problem is that it creates a new level of uncertainty as to the value and usefulness of my property. And if it does that without improving the values and the functions of the river, then I have questions. I wonder, what am I getting for this? So that's really the issue there. Another issue is specifically with that was mentioned right at the beginning about tree harvesting. So I have this little parking area in front of my garage. I guess it's called an apron. In that area, there are some trees. These trees are dying slowly. We don't want them to die, but they're dying slowly. My concern is, should I hear of a hurricane or the vestiges of one coming up, and I wanted to cut these trees. I wanted to do it that day because I was concerned they were going to blow over onto the cars or cause a serious problem, even the house. Under this class reclassification, as I understand it, that would constitute a harvesting of these trees, and I would have had to submit and get approved a prior harvesting plan to cut these trees. I suppose I could argue after the fact that there was an emergent threat to health and safety, but again, the outcome of that is uncertain because of these laws. It's uncertain because I have to go to the state and in effect defend myself for having done this emergency harvesting, or I would say tree cutting. So that is a real concern to me. Second area, of course, is flooding, which you've heard a lot about in Houston. And my concern there is, if there is an imminent threat of flooding, if the lake again reaches a record high level, and I wish to do emergency excavation on my property to mitigate that flooding or the possibility that my house will be flooded or my basement will be flooded, can I do that without seeking a state permit first? And if as a result of that excavation, dirty water from a trench flows into the LaCroix, am I then liable to defend myself against a state fine or state action against me? All of this would be a concern to anyone who wished to purchase my property from me. They would ask these same questions. And even if we could assure them, based on your assurances and other assurances, no, that will never happen, or the state supports that, or this language is there, or there's grandfathering, the uncertainty surrounding that would lower the value of the property. So, after all that, I'm not against the petition in concept. So this is what I would say. I conclude by saying that as temporary stewards of a small part of the LaCroix, small part of the LaCroix and its life forms, we are in sympathy with anyone who wants to protect it for future generations. My concern here is that in voicing this desire in this exact form, as we see it, all we have to go on is the petition and the map as they've drawn it, and the statute as it exists now, as your rules that I think you put in place about a year ago revised, tell us no real additional protection is achieved, but some of our own quiet enjoyment may be replaced by anxiety, expense, and a diminution of our free enjoyment of this wonderful area. Thank you.
And that's certainly the a part of the discussion here is there's increased scrutiny, increased area that's going to be reviewed by the state versus whether that's needed or important for maintaining the integrity of this wetland. Now, I'm sure, Charlie, you're not considering paving the entirety of the 100-foot zone. You probably like having lawn and shrubs and such, but I think what a 100-foot buffer zone does for Class 1 wetlands is it prevents that further creep of not entirely prevent all development, but certainly prevents too much activity from happening within those buffer zones. So about half of this wetland is protected with easements and such. Is that enough to protect the entirety of this wetland? Do we need to look out 100 feet to other sections of this wetland? And those are all things that we're reviewing as part of this petition. So that was everybody who checked off the checkbox. Thank you for coming. Who wanted to provide a comment. Oh, and we have another one.
Yes.
Thank you. So, Robin Jeffers.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I'm here because I actually just bought a 1-acre lot in December that is, like the gentleman who just spoke, one of the borders is center line of the river. And it has a building envelope that is just over the 50-foot buffer zone. So if this change were to take place, then the lot that I just purchased would have no area left for the building envelope at all. So I'm not opposed to doing anything to protect the river, but I am pretty shook up about having just made a pretty expensive building investment in a lot on the river. I purchased it. What was attractive to me about it was that it was on the river, and I imagined having a cute little house and being able to go kayaking out of it, just like other folks who want to enjoy the river. So, glad to see the river saved in any way possible, but if I can't build a house on that lot, then I would really kind of hate to buy the lot back for what I paid for it. And what it's costing me.
Well, Robin, we can certainly talk with you look at where your parcel is and see how we might look at a permit application for building on that site. I think that would be helpful.
That would be helpful, but like the gentleman just spoke before, I mean, right now there's no need to go through that extra level of permitting. It's approved with the town. It's approved for wastewater. It's approved drinking water. It's got all of its current approvals. I could, in theory, just hurry up and go hire an excavator and go dig a foundation hole like next week.
Did you say a portion of the Class 2 wetland buffer boundary is on the lot?
Yes.
Or, okay.
Yes, it comes because my property goes into the middle of the river.
Yeah.
It comes up 50 feet into the lot. And the lot is much more than 100 feet. So if you take the other 100 feet, then it's over, and I don't think that I should be subject to additional expense in the permitting at the state level. Ordinary or all the
So you've heard from a number of people who have their own little access to grind line among them. Does the state ever say, oh, okay, we know it's a wetland, this is the wetland line, we've reclassified it, but for purposes of these particular people in their particular situation, we're going to pretend that it's not. In other words, once you follow the science, and then once you agree that it meets the legal criteria, does it necessarily have to take effect for that 100 foot? Or can you modify that on paper so that such permitting would not be required for these grandfathered properties?
That's a very good question. So for the buffer zone, we're looking at buffers that mean something for the wetland itself. And to give you an example, Chickering Fen was recently designated as Class 1, and the proposal was for a 300-foot buffer zone. And the reason for that is because fens have very small watersheds, and having a 300-foot buffer zone would protect that watershed from degradation and keep the water quality good and sound within that wetland. There was concerns from an adjacent landowner, and what he stated was actually that out 300 feet wasn't exactly within the watershed. After speaking with him, we looked at the topography of that area and found that, in fact, going out 240 feet, the slope actually shifted from going towards the wetland to going away from the wetland. And so you can look at the way Appendix A in the wetland rules is written, and it was written to exclude that area because that portion of buffer zone wasn't meeting the intended need for that wetland. And that was done before the petition was finalized and before it became law. So that's certainly something that has precedence and something that we've considered in the past. So if there's a proposal for changes to the buffer zone which have some sort of an ecological reason for changing that, that's something that the program could certainly consider for a rule change if we do in fact go forward with this petition. So I just wanted to mention we now have received all of the comments from folks who wanted to make comments, but we still have a bit of time. I'm hoping to potentially wrap up at 7:30, but right now I'll take other comments and questions from the group. And I saw one hand raised here and one in the back, and then up front again. So we'll start.
If you could
just state your name again.
Jerry Story.
Yeah, thanks.
Excuse me. As a technical question, does the law permit you, other than a wholesale application of a buffering zone of 100 feet or any dimension, or can you segment the buffering zone property by property, feature by feature, or in some other way? In other words, can you have a buffering zone that's 100 feet for a period of distance, and then 50, and then back to 100? Or does the law give you that discretion, or does the law require you to apply a 100-foot zone regardless?
So that's a good question, and I need to double check in the rules on whether it can be reduced from 100 feet or not, because I know that the rules state that there's a default of 100 feet, but it's the intention written in the rules is that the state can determine what the appropriate buffer zone width would be for the protection of functions and values. So I can look into that more, yeah. Certainly.
A rephrased question. I'm sorry.
I wouldn't... to change the buffer zone based off of property ownership would not be an ecological basis for... So if there was a change in the ecology, like slopes or... land usage and such like that, that would be considered, but not an arbitrary line on the landscape.
And then as a quick follow-up, and I appreciate your indulging me, is your default is 100 feet because you can go to as much as 1,000. Does that mean that the minimal requirement will be 100, even if you had authority to segment it under ecological
that's,
conditions?
That's what I need to follow.
We'd appreciate
along.
That. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And in the back, your name?
I'm Ron Gagnon. I have a question actually for this gentleman. How did you decide originally on the La Platte River? I'm curious. It's not via the alphabet. You have Nisiskoi, right, game preserve, ecologically important. Why here? Why just this one? Are you going to start going to all the 150-some rivers?
I think we've been involved with, the NRC has been involved with 4 or 5 designations throughout the course of the wetland rules, and this has been, as the representative from the Nature Conservancy said, this has been known to be a very special area for a long time. I mean, there are other very special areas as well, and if the state doesn't act to reclassify, you know, and they did, they just took action to reclassify a number of wetlands, we will look at other wetland areas, but this has just been a known, really special area for a very long time, as you've heard. So there are other special wetlands that are known, and you know, we have limited resources and we can go one at a time, but
I'm asking, yeah. Why did you pick this one?
Because there's so much known about this, and for all the reasons that you heard today, it doesn't mean that there are other special areas. I mean, like I said, went to the North Shore Wetland in Burlington, and that was when we were involved with Lake Bombazine Wetland, Victory Bog.
Right, but bogs, rivers, lakes, but this is a river.
No, the North Shore is not a lake. It's a wetland along the lake. And I mean, I'm not going to argue with you.
Why the first river?
It's not the first river. It's not that the fact that it's not the first river, I don't think. It's just that there's a lot known about the special nature of this wetland. And it's something that we felt deserved protection. And there are others as well. And once we get through this, we can move on to look at other ones.
And
we will. Thanks.
I had a few questions or comments.
One of them was,
yes, my name is Gail Albert, and I'm on the Natural Resources Committee here in Shelburne. And I'm aware that there are many, many landowners who may be affected here, and there was not a great deal of notice for this, so I wonder if you could make a public announcement about where people who might not have been able to make it to this meeting could get to you with comments, just to make sure we've reached everyone. It's sort of the end of summer, a holiday week, and the first day of school. So I want to make sure everybody has had that opportunity.
So like a news announcement?
Another one, yeah.
Yeah.
And then a couple of other comments. As you do site visits in these places that have been raised as having issues, we would really appreciate being invited to go along if that were possible.
So we, as in the committee,
if you're doing, or members of the town, so to speak. The Natural Resources Committee or the Select Board, so that we better understand what we have here. the Natural Resources Committee has been working for as long as I've been on the committee, almost 25 years, to protect the La Platte River. And with the help of the Nature Conservancy and other organizations, we've been able to protect a great deal of it. And I think it would certainly help our understanding to see the designations that you make. So if that's at all possible, I'm not sure that we would be able to join you, but I think it would be really educational for us.
Well, that decision would be up to the landowner as to whether they would allow people other than us, but we can certainly ask that landowner. Maybe what we could also do a specific site visit to an area that's accessible, that's public land, to talk with members of the town and about the site. We've done that with past Class 1 wetlands, where we've done a walk around the wetland to, you know, talk about what we're seeing and what we're evaluating when we go out to sites. Would that be something that
I think anything like that would be really helpful and educational.
I think that might
not
be
all
similar.
Of us have PhDs in ecology who are on the committee, and I think it would be really, really helpful. Okay. And then my last question has to do with exemptions, and I'm not sure that you have an answer for this, but with exemptions such as we talked about with the salt sheds and those kinds of installations, I know that they're federal exemptions and they go back for over 100 years, but they seem to be the most damaging types of things that can occur. And how is it that there hasn't been some kind of movement to be able to address those exemptions so that they cannot occur?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Federal exemptions are, you know, certainly out of
it's
the program's
not, it's
hands.
It's not a burden for you,
yeah.
But it's a question that I think is really important.
Yeah, more of a rhetorical question for everybody. Yeah. The wetland rules are also, we're considering making some changes to the rules to improve the clarity, the efficiency of running the program and protections. Where we had a large stakeholder group of 30 folks. This is kind of diving out of the La Platte piece, but this is a good forum to just mention that we have been discussing the wetland rules, the exemptions, the allowed uses, and right now we're not proposing to change them, but we are considering changes right now. So for your information. Gentleman in the back, your name?
My name is Mark Santa. You may have mentioned this, I was a little late. Can you just give me an outline of the process for how this is going to move forward and the process for a homeowner, a business owner, a property owner, on what they need to do to address, you know, their concerns with the board? I know people that are here are obviously aware of it. But
yep.
And how this process kind of plays out over the course of the petition.
Yep, so right now we have a petition from BNRC, which the state is evaluating. We're going to combine all of the comments that we're receiving. The comment period ends September 13th, so there will be more time after this meeting to submit written comments. And I believe our last sheet may have gone away, so we'll write down that email address that you can submit comments to. Once the comment period closes, we're going to review all the comments, do a responsiveness summary, continue evaluating the petition. Then we'll make a recommendation to our commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, and she'll decide whether to deny the permit or the petition, or move the petition on to the rulemaking process. which is a formal process that involves the legislature, the committee for changing administrative rules, where we'll have to do a filing, have another public comment period for consideration. We may make some changes to the proposal in there. We may make some changes now after we've had these discussions, too. And then it goes through a legislative hearing and either approved or denied there. And if it's approved, then it will be the responsibility of the agency to publish and enact new rules. So that's we're still at the early stages. I'm glad that we've had, you know, we have a good showing here tonight. I think it would be great to get more outreach. Certainly, tell your neighbors about this petition, what you've learned today, because there's more time for comments, and we want to make this as transparent as possible and have people understand. Did that answer all of your questions?
Will you be responding to all the town's concerns?
The town will be. They stated that they will be submitting a written comment as well as their verbal comments for me to respond to, which I'll be doing. And if you would like to see that responsiveness summary, please put your email address on the sign-in sheet, and we'll add you to the list of folks who received the response summary and any updates of what stage in the process this petition is in. Okay. Next comment?
Yeah, just a quick question. In terms of the site visits that you've offered to make, will you be reaching out to those landowners in the town, or should we follow up with you to coordinate a site visit?
So we have notes from today on who had concerns. We offered a site visit. No one said definitively whether they wanted one or not. So it's up to them to contact us to see if if we should go out onto their site or not. It's their property.
So I'm the district ecologist for Chittenden, so I work with Shelburne here. So what I can do, I can just write my email up on the whiteboard here, and you can contact me directly for a request for a site visit, and then we can figure things out from there.
Was there a comment in the front? Any other comments for this meeting?
Thank
I'm not
you.
Seeing any hands. You're welcome.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, well, thanks, and this will adjourn the meeting, and all of you who have put your information up here, we'll be in touch. Thank you.